Hello and welcome to another episode of Going Deep with Aaron Watson. Thank you so much for listening. If you are not already a subscriber, please make sure, whether you're listening to this on Stitcher or iTunes or whatever podcatcher, that you hit that subscribe button so that you do not miss another episode of Going Deep with Aaron Watson. There are many great guests coming down the pipeline, but today's fantastic guest is Sean Amirati. Sean is both a partner at Birchmere Venture Capital and a professor at Carnegie Mellon University. Sean's also successfully grown multiple businesses, sold them, and has a lot of wisdom to dispense in his new book, The Science of Growth. If you're listening to this on the Monday that it came out, it releases tomorrow. But if you're listening to it down the pipe, make sure you head over to Amazon or a local bookstore and get your hands on a copy, because as Sean explains in this episode, there is a ton of science behind what companies grow exponentially and really take off after they find product market fit. I'm not going to go on any longer, but please enjoy my interview with Sean Amirati. Sean, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me, Aaron.
For the listeners at home, a little bit of laugh on my end, because we've just basically recorded 15 minutes of an interview that didn't really record correctly. So we're taking it again from the top. Sean is a trooper for sticking with me here. Let's start off, Sean. You are currently both an adjunct professor at Carnegie Mellon University and a partner at the VC firm Birchmere Partners. Both of these are really cool positions, I'm sure. You get to have some really cool conversations and experiences in both of these positions. And you've done a lot of work for the doors to be open for you to be in these two really cool roles. And I want to talk about where that kind of started. Your first company, MSpoke, of which you were a co-founder, that you started out of university at CMU. Can you start off by just painting us a little picture of your first company and what you did there?
Yeah, so back in 2001, I actually dropped out of a research fellowship program at Carnegie Mellon. And the first incarnation of MSpoke that I joined was a company called Peak Strategy. And what Peak did is it helped traders on Wall Street predict patterns in stock prices based on historical data. So this was before big data and machine learning were buzzwords that many of your audience will be familiar with today. But certainly, finance has a long history of large data sets and being able to do optimizations around that. And we had unique technology to help with that. When we sold that business to Morgan Stanley, we stepped back and looked at the underlying technology and realized that it was also extremely applicable in this space of making smart recommendations to people on, instead of if a stock price would go up and down for a trader, a piece of content, and if that content would be interesting to an end consumer or not. So is this news article or blog post interesting to Aaron or not, using the same machine learning algorithms? So we spent the next few years working on that. We went through a number of different iterations trying to think about, you know, the right go-to-market strategy for commercializing this sort of algorithmic editor, if you will, or algorithmic curator, if you will. And ultimately, after a bunch of those iterations, sold that business to LinkedIn, and then it was used in different ways there. Some of the engineering team continued to work with the folks at LinkedIn for a number of years, and you know, today you have, you know, news articles being recommended to people based on their LinkedIn profiles through a product at LinkedIn called LinkedIn Today.
Very cool. After that, you joined a company called Read Write Web, which is a bit of a tongueful, but I had a little practice enunciating it before. Did you immediately jump right into that? Did you take some downtime after MSpoke was acquired? What was your mentality there?
Yeah, so I got involved in Read Write right away, and that it was an interesting business. So unlike Peak and MSpoke, where we had raised money from outsiders, Read Write was a business that grew organically, and so it was bootstrapped before I got involved, and even when I joined, I became an owner of the business, but VS, they call it sweat equity, not capital, and really helped the business over the next few years transform from a blog with a couple of writers into, I think, a really interesting long-form modern media company focused on the future of technology for enterprise technologists, and ultimately sold that to a private equity roll-up firm in 24 years ago now, so late 2010, and then have been part of Birchmere for the last few years, as you said.
Absolutely. And with all these companies, as you've explained, that they were able to get acquired kind of as a method of how you left the business, but also, I don't know if you would say define success. Was that a outset goal when you got started? Was that something that was just an opportunity that you took advantage of when the time came? And maybe along with that question, two parts. You mentioned that the ReadWrite Web was bootstrapped while the others were venture funded. How did those kind of change your perspective and the decision-making process around the offers that you received?
Yeah, I mean, so having investors is certainly one way to build a business. As a partner at a venture firm, it's a way that I spend a lot of time talking to people about building businesses. It's certainly not the right path for every startup or for every entrepreneur, for that matter. But, you know, I think in all of these cases, a good rule of thumb is, you know, you want to build an entity that's really valuable. And long term, there's lots of ways to capitalize on that value. But as it relates to acquisitions, one of the things that I think is important to keep in mind is that, you know, great companies are bought, not sold, right? And so when you don't have to sell the business, but you have something that's valuable and growing and able to continue to grow through organic means, in the case of ReadWrite, or in other businesses, maybe through continuing to finance that business, you know, there are lots of options in front of you, and that allows you to have very different conversations with potential acquirers because you're building something of value. And so that was sort of how we looked at it. I think it's important for entrepreneurs to keep in mind that, you know, when you raise money, that, you know, you are changing some of the dynamics. You know, I think there are lots of good things about raising venture capital. I wouldn't be doing this as a job if I didn't think that there were lots of businesses that would benefit from raising capital. But certainly there are entrepreneurs that I sit down with all the time where that may not be the right way for them to build their business. And even more broadly, when I think about a term like entrepreneur, you know, the way I look at it is, this is somebody, a person where he or she sees the world the way it ought to be and builds a product or service to satisfy that need. And so certainly high tech, high growth startups fit into that bucket of entrepreneurial activity. And that's where I spend a lot of my time. But, you know, certainly a local coffee shop can fit into that, where they're creating a product and a service and a retail establishment that a neighborhood needs. Or even through some of the stuff I do at Carnegie Mellon and their executive education program, it's interesting to watch high-performing executives inside large companies apply this entrepreneurial mindset to creating new products and services for those businesses.
Absolutely. I'm really curious to unpack that a little bit more, because you've kind of worn or wear these different hats, a mentor at Carnegie Mellon, an investor at a venture capital firm, previously an entrepreneur that did in companies that did not raise capital. When you are sitting down with an entrepreneur and they're asking for your advice, not about how to raise money or, you know, something super granular with their company, but more specifically, is raising money the right call, or is bootstrapping the right call? What are some of the metrics or primary considerations that you're looking for when you're giving advice to that end?
Well, I think it comes down to a variety of things. What that entrepreneur's ambitions are for the given business, the size of the opportunity. So if that entity is successful, you know, how large could it ultimately be? And then obviously the way they're thinking about, you know, what success looks like down the road for them. It's really, really hard to build a multi-100 million or billion-dollar business organically off of cash flow. And so, you know, if that's the ambition that the entrepreneur has, the likelihood is that they're going to need some growth capital to help them finance that business appropriately. But there are many other businesses where that doesn't make sense, or maybe they only need just a little bit of capital. And so maybe instead of an institutional investor like myself, an individual investing in the business, or what are often called an angel investor, may make more sense for them. And in some cases, you know, I think Read Write Web worked out really well for us because we didn't raise capital. A number of other technology, blog, and media properties like us at the time did step out and raise a lot of capital. And I think the results were really much better for all three of the shareholders because we didn't raise outside capital.
Gotcha. So after leaving Read Write Web, in terms of your position now with Birchmere Partners, I'm sure doors were open due to the fact that you'd had these successes in the entrepreneurial space. But what attracted you to the world of venture capital and maybe also specifically Birchmere Partners?
Yeah, so I had already started teaching at Carnegie Mellon, and the role of teaching at CMU is very much a part-time thing. It's maybe more better described as I do get paid, but maybe more better described as a hobby than an occupation. But stepping back onto campus and spending time with students, I came to really appreciate how much I enjoyed working with these brilliant entrepreneurs. And I had gotten to know one of my partners at Birchmere Ventures, Ned Renzi, September 11th, when the planes crashed into the World Trade Center and all that. Both Ned and I were in Tucson, Arizona together at a technology conference. And we ended up driving from Tucson to Pittsburgh together along with two other folks. And it was really a sort of bonding experience, you know, 44 hours in the car together. I didn't know Ned that well when we got into the car in Tucson. In fact, I didn't know him at all before meeting him at that conference earlier in the week. But by the time we got back into Pittsburgh, you know, we sort of shared this experience together. And over the next, you know, dozen years, he and I would get together pretty regularly just to compare notes on, you know, things I was working on. He would give me advice. I would talk to him about things I thought were interesting. Hopefully some of them he found interesting. But we ended up, you know, having this relationship where every 3 to 6 months we would get together and just catch up. And after I sold Read Write to Say, you know, the next key objective for me was to obviously figure out what I was going to do next, because I knew I probably wasn't a great fit for me to stay at Say Media. And so I was trying to figure out what the right next step would be, and realized that maybe instead of doing another startup myself, which was sort of the default position, working at a fund like Birchmere may allow me to add some leverage and some scale to this activity that I had been enjoying doing at Carnegie Mellon, working with entrepreneurs, helping them create these products and services that were meaningful. And so they actually approached me about an opportunity. They had to create a new fund inside the firm, Birchmere Labs, as sort of a test case, which I did with them. And then ultimately, a couple years ago, when we raised our next significant fund, joined as a partner in that fund as well.
So in addition to that, you are working as a professor at CMU. And I know that some of your experiences at CMU were the catalyst for your idea to write this book that I want to make sure that we get the chance to talk about, The Science of Growth. So can you talk a little bit now, as we're wrapping things up, about where the idea to write The Science of Growth came from, and also elaborate a little bit on your writing process? That's something we've had some other guests who've come on, some authors, and always curious to learn about the process of writing a book. Is it something you bang out in, you know, a few weeks, just locking yourself in a room? Is it something that slowly develops over time, and what that process was like?
Sure. So, yeah. So as I said, I've been teaching at Carnegie Mellon now for over 5 years. When I started teaching at Carnegie Mellon, I started teaching a course called Lean Entrepreneurship, which was basically the Lean Startup methodology in a classroom setting. And really that course became very popular, helping people take ideas and figure out how to commercialize them, or what in startup parlance is often called go from idea to product market fit, where a simple definition of product market fit is, you know, a good product in a good market that solves a real problem. And, you know, there's a bunch of really well understood at this point best practices from some of the literature out there on how to do that. And we've turned that into a course. And I think it's it's a great resource for students. But walking out of class one night, 3.5 years ago now, one of my students said to me, hey, you know, this course was great, but, you know, for most of us, the real challenge is not going from idea to product market fit, but product market fit to scale. And he said, what I'd really love is the same type of course that you teach here, but instead of using it as the sort of front end of this entrepreneurship process, what about teaching us, you know, how we can join a company that may have raised a few million dollars and is looking to scale up, so that maybe the choice is less go to Google or start a company, and maybe it's more join a venture-backed startup or go to Google. And I thought that was really interesting. And so I started looking for a text similar to Eric's Lean Startup as a kind of anchor text for that material. Couldn't find anything. And so I started working with students on campus to build out case studies of pairs of companies that had gotten to product market fit at about the same time, but one took off and one didn't. So why did Facebook took off and Friendster didn't, or Tesla versus Fisker, or WordPress versus Movable Type? And we ended up building 10 of those case studies. And as we were doing that, started to observe some really common patterns. And, you know, my goal at this point in the process was really not to write a book at all. It was to create a complimentary course on campus to my Lean Entrepreneurship course that students could take afterwards to wrestle with this other problem, or this other, I guess, intellectual challenge as they embark on their career. And so we turned that into a course, and the course was extremely popular. And then one of my mentors from Carnegie Mellon when I was a grad student there, who's an author as well, recommended that I turn it into a book, introduced me to his agent, and it's kind of the content sort of took on a life of its own. So I've now taught the course a few times, and, you know, from January to July of last year, that was actually the process of creating the manuscript, and then over the last 6 months, it's been more an editing and a production process. But from January to July of last year, really spent every weekend in my office at Birchmere over the weekend working on translating class notes and case studies and into the text that ultimately will actually be a book people can buy next Tuesday.
Yeah, absolutely. This will be going up on Monday, so people could tomorrow. Be listening to it way down the road. But yeah, it'll be tomorrow if you're listening to this as it just came out. And one of the things that, as you were talking about the book, both just now and a couple weeks ago when I heard you talk about it for the first time, that got me really excited is this kind of comparison case study way that you've set it up. So you mentioned these different companies. Why does McDonald's explode and White Castle is kind of still a niche burger joint? And it's really interesting because I think that maybe to some people who really don't dig into it, when you see a huge company like Tesla, some people may just jump to the idea that, oh, this was a unique idea that no one else had, and not really appreciate that there are other companies trying to make electric cars, but for whatever reason, their execution just didn't kind of match up to the same level. I know that we're definitely going to direct people to check out the book, and there's a lot of nuance that we can't go over in, you know, the next 5 minutes or so of the conversation. But as you were kind of unpacking these different case studies, was there any findings that surprised you that whether you or, you know, one of your students is there putting these case studies together, that you're kind of surprised to be finding consistently in these different examples of success or failure?
Yeah, so I think there are a couple things along that line. One was that, you know, we really, when we started it, we were thinking about it more as kind of a checklist or a set of best practices that you could just do. But part of what we realized is, like, that's not exactly the right way to think about it, that actually these companies go through multiple phases of growth, and you want to give the right recommendations at the right point in time, which is, I think, way more accurate, but a little less sort of catchy and, you know, 30-second micro-chunk piece of advice that often people are looking for. So we spend time in the book trying to help you understand both where you are in this process of scaling up and then the right things to do at that point. In terms of recommendations at different points along the way, there were a number of things I think that ended up being interesting. I think one thing that is kind of a unique twist on it that I really didn't want to include a lot about, and I actually pushed back pretty hard when we were doing the research originally about including it, was this concept of a high-performing team. And the challenge there is that I didn't want – I think the easy way to describe it is like, well, Tesla had talented people and Fisker didn't. And that's just not true. I mean, there were really talented people at both of these places. But what we did come to observe was that the way they managed their recruiting processes, who owned the recruiting process, things like that, were very different. And there were concrete recommendations we were able to make around how you run those processes. Probably another one at that stage of rapid growth that I thought that I found interesting is I would have suspected when you're in this period of exponential growth or rapid growth, that it would be important to be doing lots of different things to accelerate that growth. But in fact, we found this culture of focus and discipline across a lot of the companies that scaled up that we thought was particularly relevant and helpful advice for entrepreneurs in that phase of rapid growth, which interestingly is very, very different advice than you'd give somebody at the beginning of the process where they're trying to get to that product market fit, where they need to be running lots of different experiments to really figure out what the thing with the essence of the idea is that has this potential to scale.
That's really interesting. I guess there is a kind of a Goldilocks zone in terms of experimentation where if you get too bogged down in just trying to iterate and iterate and iterate, you can get a little caught in the weeds there. That's been very insightful, Sean. Thank you so much for coming on the program and sharing all this wisdom. We're going to tell people how to connect with you and learn more about in the book in a second. But before we do that, is there anything I just didn't give you a chance to say?
No, that was a great conversation, Aaron.
Cool. So if people want to learn more about the science of growth, get the book, or learn more about you, where's the best place to connect in the digital world?
Yeah, so the book should be available anywhere they want in the digital world now, even if they're listening to this on Monday in pre-orders and certainly afterwards, anywhere. So it's been turned into an audiobook, so you can download it on Audible. It's on all the Kindle, iBooks, all of that, and then certainly Amazon and Barnes & Noble online and any local bookstore will have copies as well or should have copies as well. In terms of connecting with me, Twitter is probably the easiest place to interact with me, but people are also always happy to send me an email. It's just my first and last name at gmail.com, and I'm not as responsive as I aspire to be on that, but you know, do my best to be responsive on the different platforms.
Fantastic. All that will be linked to in the show notes at goingdeepwithaaron.com/podcast. Make sure you check out the book, whether you're an audiobook listener or want to get a physical copy in your hands. We will link that out as well. But Sean, I'm going to give you the mic one last time so that you can take it away with a personal challenge for the audience.
Yeah, so I was thinking about this while we were talking, what would be a good personal challenge. And, you know, one of the things that I think is interesting about entrepreneurship, right, is that statistically, the likely outcome is that the idea you have just won't work out. But I think we tend to over-focus on the downside scenario and risky things like that and underestimate the upside in those. And so I thought one thing that would be an interesting personal challenge for personal development for your audience that I still try to do myself on a regular basis is at least once a week try to do something where I expect the outcome to be a no or not work out, you know, whether that's reach out to somebody who you don't expect them to respond to you or try something that you don't think you'll be good at, because I think we need to do a better job conditioning ourselves to understand that in the right settings, failure is not nearly as scary as we as humans tend to think it is.
I think that is fantastic advice. I think that particularly when you're young, but at all times, taking those chances can really open doors and unlock a potential that I think we're all chasing in some way or another. So thank you for that challenge, and thank you for coming on the show, Sean. We just went deep with Sean Amirati. Hope everyone out there has a fantastic day.
Thanks, Aaron.
Hey everyone, hope you enjoyed today's episode and learned a lot from listening to Sean. I'm very thankful that he came on the show and shared some time with us. If you want to get his book, once again, make sure you head over to Amazon or bookstore, wherever you go to get your books, and check it out. Also, make sure you hit that subscribe button so that you can stay up to date with all future episodes. Our next episode will be an interview with Chris Hill. Chris has introduced multiple podcasts under the Motley Fool and produces a show daily, every weekday, and he went into great depths, both to talk about finance, which is what he covers in his Motley Fool interviews, but also the growth and the building of these different podcasts, how he prepares for guests, how he spends his time in between episodes, post-production, pre-production. Very, very insightful. A little bit of inside baseball, but if you enjoyed previous interviews like the ones with Morgan Housel, Bob Seawright, I think you'll really enjoy this one as well. So make sure you stay tuned, and thank you so much for listening.